It's over. It does. Actually, it's just beginning. It's the news, according to me. Yeah, it's over for someone. The time is 7:15 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, June 5th, 2025. And I am your host with something in my throat. I have no idea what's going on with this. This weird raspy thing going on. Let's just try that. How's that? Is that better? That's a little better. I think maybe what I need is just keep playing music. Let's keep playing the music. There we go. That sounds better. Oh, anyway, there we go. A sip of chai did the process there. And we have a lot of things to get into today. One of the things we need to get into is what's in my cup. And not going to get into my cup. It's too small. I'm a very large man. We have very, very large, huge. You know, those of you who know me personally, just keep quiet right now. I have chai with almond joy creamer. It's a vanilla latte chai. I have a little something different in my backup cup. Something that you probably won't be expecting. Yesterday I did make a fresh batch. Actually, last night I made a fresh batch. Call it a batch. A fresh container, gallon of sweet tea, homemade sweet tea with peaches in it. Sliced fresh peaches. Put in there. Now I have some peaches in my cup as well. However, the peaches I have in my cup were from leftover from the previous administration of tea. The tea, however, that is in my cup right now. Sorry, I'm having a coughing fit. The tea is from a place called Texas Corral. Now, some of you may have maybe aware of what Texas Corral is. Some of you may not. It's not Texas Roadhouse. It's different. Two different things. Texas Roadhouse is a very popular restaurant around this area. Anytime you go to one, in fact, anywhere around the country, that when I go to a Texas Roadhouse, it is usually busy. It doesn't matter. Seems to matter what night of the week it is. Of course, weekends are a bigger deal, but any night of the week, Texas Roadhouse tends to be very busy. Many of them are not open for lunch. There are a few that are open at that hour, but there are most of them do not open until 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon in most places in the country. So you can't get lunch there, but you can get dinner, and it is supper, dinner, whatever you want to call it, wherever you are in that whole thing. There's a place called Texas Corral. That is a little, I think it's a more of a regional restaurant. I don't know that it's all over the place. I have never seen it in certain parts of the country. And I'm not sure if it might be more regional restaurant. The problem with a lot of these chain restaurants like Olive Garden, Red Lobsters are going away. I'm not sure if they're going to all go away, if they're just cutting way back. There are very few of them around anymore. In this region, there's only one. It's in Mishawaka. There used to be one in Elkhart, Mishawaka, South. There was one in, there was one in Michigan City. they've been all over the place. They're closing. I think the one even in up in St. Joe is closed. There's very few in the area, and it's hard to see them, find them. I find them very rarely around the country. I think they were poorly run. I think that was the biggest problem with Red Lobster, but that's just my opinion. I think they tried a little too late to try to get things coming back, and it just didn't happen. The reason I'm saying all that is because if you look into the way they prepare most of their food, the way they do most of their food, most of their food is sourced out regionally. Even the salads aren't chopped and cut in the restaurant in many of these places. They're all done by a. It's an interesting. They pretty much just have everything prepackaged. They throw it in a microwave, and it's like an assembly line. They really don't cook anything. You know, the refried beans, the places like some of the Mexican restaurants, Taco Bell, that kind of place. A lot of them are very, very just assembly line-like type things. There's, you know, it's not like there's a cook in the back doing anything. So it's a very different thing to go to a restaurant that has a cook. Olive Garden, you know, it's not authentic Italian food. It's not at all. If you want to go to an authentic place around here, Tony Campolo has a place called, what's the name of it? Now I can't even think. I knew it was going to happen to me. I wasn't even thinking about it until I was doing this little talk. Maybe he would sponsor me. Maybe I could remember what it is, but I can't. That's authentic Italian food. His family's from Italy. He wins prizes in doing pizza. He does international pizza competitions, and he's the real deal. He doesn't speak with an accent. He just has an awesome restaurant. Very Italian-like. And those are the kind of places that are authentic, and they make their, you know, it's kind of farm-to-table type places that are a little bit more, you know, there's no processing intermediate place where they process the food. So anyway, Texas Corral, I believe, is one of those places that it's a little kind of the in-between type place. It's not a huge chain. I think a lot of their sourcing for their foods are, my dog is doing weird things. So I think they have a little bit more authentic, but now just saying all that to say this, their sweet tea is probably one of the best. I mean, I like the sweet tea at Texas Roadhouse and some other places as well, some of the chain places. I would say Texas Corral's sweet tea is probably very, very close, if not as good as, you guessed it, Chick-fil-A. Now, Chick-fil-A is the premier king, well, the queen maybe. I'm the king of making sweet tea. As far as food restaurants out there, Chick-fil-A is king. The other side of this is that the other thing that makes this more interesting is the presentation. They bring you a great big mason jar. I mean, it's not a small mason jar. It is a large mason jar full of sweet tea with, they put a little too much ice in it because but the tea is smooth and it goes down, and I had some left over. It was the jug was so big. I ate my salmon. I had grilled salmon and a mashed potato, loaded mashed potato, and a salad. And I had all that with bread, but you know the bread crap that stuff comes with it. But anyway, the tea, it was worth going. I wouldn't care how the food was. It was just the tea was good, and it was. I actually had tea left over. They just brought me a little cup to put the tea in. I took that cup of tea and put it in my regular cup that I have in my car and filled it up, and it filled the cup up. So that's how much was left over. Fill my cup, Lord. Fill it up, Lord. And I'm still drinking it this morning. I actually brought it home. Of course, now I had peaches left in the cup from the day before or from yesterday. And it has sat all night in the refrigerator. So now I have Texas Corral sweet tea permeated with my peaches. It's pretty good. It's pretty good stuff. It's a little bit, it's okay. It's good. No, it's very good stuff. So I had quite a bit of ice in it, which has kind of melted now, which has kind of watered it down a little bit. Not quite as good as it was. Probably would have been if it was like too super fresh. Super fresh. So, onward and upward. It's going to be a fairly short show, believe it or not. But that's pretty much the show. I guess it's time to go, and we'll see you later. This is it's been a good show, and that's all there is to do it. That's the case. I have a couple things I want to talk about. One is this Karine Jean-Pierre. Karine Jean-Pierre, KJP. It's interesting. I want to talk about two things. One is this book deal thing. Everybody's got a book deal. They're all out there writing books because, you know, it's so easy to write a book. Why don't you try it sometime? You know how few people actually write books and write and get them completed? My grandpa wrote a book. I think he wrote two books, I guess. And one of them was more like a pamphlet, but he self-published. Now, keep in mind, he self-published in 1989. No, it was 1988, I think. That's when it came out. He was almost 90 years old when he published that book. Maybe there's hope for me yet. I've got another 30 years. A little less. But, maybe I'll get something published out of there before. In this age of speech to text, AI, everything. And I'm not going to use AI. If I write a book, AI is not going to be able to. I might use AI as an editor, maybe, to find mistakes or something like that. To how to word certain content might be helpful to kind of use as a sounding board type thing. But I'm not going to find content and use content. It's going to come right from my head and heart out my little fingers to type into. Now I might do speech to text in some, just to take notes. That's one thing. A lot of things I've compiled over the years. Putting things together. The problem with doing a book the kind of book I'm writing, it has to do with a lot of contemporary things that are going on in the world. And so things are always changing. And it just seems like so many things keep happening in the world that it's hard to keep up on all these things. But however, so I've had to take kind of a more of a generalized approach with the writing of the book. But people are coming up. Now, I could hire a ghostwriter. They come and interview you. You go over all this stuff. You work for a couple of days or maybe a week with this ghostwriter, and you go through all the different aspects of the book. Then they come up with a projected time of giving you a rough draft. You go over the rough draft. It's this back and forth kind of thing. And people think that that's writing a book. That's not writing a book. There are authors out there that write books. There are people who just have other people write books for them. And then especially these people that are in the media, people like Bill Barr, who was a former attorney general under Trump. People like Jake Tapper. Karine Jean-Pierre now is coming out with a book. Everybody has a book to write. These are ghostwriter books. They're not writing a book. They're compiling information from somebody else to write the book. Mike Pence wrote a book. James Comey has recently written a book, and now he is all over the. He had to go on a book tour. I believe Tim Walz might have written a book since the election, or he has one coming out since the election, I think, or something. I'm not sure about what all that's all about, but we'll see what happens with that. It's just a rumor at this point. He's never announced anything. Karine Jean-Pierre, I think, in the last few days, she came out and announced that she's got this book deal. It's coming out in October. How do you schedule something like that? Now, all of a sudden, she's writing a book and she's going to be independent. and she's leaving the Democrat Party. She's becoming an independent because she thinks she needs to step out of the box. This is, here we go. This is, she's going to be on some kind of book tour, who knows what. My understanding was she got a contract after she left the White House with either MSNBC or CNN as a contributor. I don't think she got her own show, but she's definitely a contributor on panels and that kind of thing. Just like Jen Psaki. And I know Jen Psaki was also one of those people that she came right out of the White House, right into, you know, CNN or MSNBC, whichever it was. I think it was MSNBC. Now, the news media, the media, the legacy media, I should say, is throwing a fit because Donald Trump is hiring all these people. I think there's 23 people now that he's hired that have close ties to Fox News. Close ties. And then not people just directly from Fox News, but they have close ties to Fox News. They were contributors or there was something. He likes people who appear on TV. Well, yeah, it happens that way. It goes both ways, buddy. Let's report on how many administrations, how many people from the administrations of the Democrats have hired people from CNN or MSNBC or that go to CNN or MSNBC after they leave a Democrat administration. The numbers are staggering. If you look at most of the people who are in the heavy anchor positions, they have done something for some administration somewhere. Many times these jobs, and you have to understand, I know like the whole story behind Al Sharpton. Al Sharpton would not have a show. He has a radio program and a television show. He would not have either one had it not been for the grifting and the strong-arming he did, the process that he went through. He got all that stuff. And forever, he will forever be in that position because of his finagling in certain administrations. The main one was Obama's administration. But he was already doing some finagling back in. So remember, that since 2008, how many of these people have gotten their own shows and that kind of thing? There was some finagling back in, even back in the Clinton administration. But these people were around, you know, Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson. My understanding is Jesse Jackson now he's off in. He's pretty much, he's a lot like Joe Biden, let's put it that way. Now, the question is, this whole thing with Jean-Pierre, they do this stuff. Now, they have to do something that maintains their relevance. Now, so Jean-Pierre now is leaving the Democrat Party, becoming independent. Stephen Miller, who's a guy who is a sportscaster who has gotten more involved in the political realm because he can. He's a black man, so he can speak out on things politically because he can say things contrary and critical of the Democrat Party because he's a black man because he has he doesn't have white privilege, so he can say those things. If you have white privilege, you can't do certain things. It's a dichotomy. It's an enigma. Conundrum. But whatever it is, all words I can't spell. Anyway, he's come out and really kind of raked you over the coals about this because he said just 2 months ago you were on The View and you were not employed by the White House anymore. You were not loyal to anybody. You didn't have to, and you still came out and said all these things that you said. And these people who are coming out and saying it's weird how this whole thing with Biden has been a divisive thing within the of course, Jake Tapper's book now is a very divisive thing. In fact, it's to the point where people on MSNBC are attacking people on CNN, and people on CNN are attacking people on MSNBC. It's quite the civil war we see breaking down. The Democrat Party is a mess right now. And now to hear the leadership, you'd think that they're fine. Oh, we're doing fine. We're feeling good about Eric Swalwell, who's trying to look like, I guess he's trying to look like, he does this. And by the way, I've seen him in person. This guy is a absolute doofus. I don't like to say things about people like that. He has this like 3-day shadow thing going on. That's part of his thing. Now, you have to understand, these people go through hair and makeup when they get on TV. When they get interviewed like this, they go through a makeup process. This is why when you see them on some kind of Zoom call and some kind of small interview they might do from home, why they look so different. You don't even recognize them. I saw Jake Tapper the other day had headphones on and he was talking. And of course, the lens on the camera typically sometimes isn't as good either. What depends on what kind of webcam they have or what they've got going on with lighting and all that stuff in the room. But I didn't recognize him. I saw the interview going on. Who is this guy? And they're talking about Tapper's book. And I realized, and then she called him Jake. And I was like, oh, I guess that's Jake Tapper. Sure enough, it was. But I didn't recognize him initially. And these people wear makeup all the time. So I'm sure that he has this little shadow thing enhanced. They can actually kind of powder it with something that makes it look a little like more uniform darkness. Otherwise, it just looks like a three-day shadow. And it's not, I think he's trying to look like Tom Cruise, what I'm getting at. He's got this thing going on. He's trying to be attractive. Let's just put it that way. He's trying to act like he's the man. And of course, that's, again, part of the Democrat Party's thing right now is this whole thing of, being more manly. And of course, they have to use cuss words. They use the same cuss words. Everybody pretty much uses the same cuss words now. They all have that figured out. So try to throw these words out there because that makes you look more rebellious and independent and kind of a little more shoot from the hip. So follow the standards by doing these things, and you'll look more radical, more. Good. That's what's going on with all that stuff. The Democrat Party's a mess, and it's now the question is now sometimes, and then this has happened before. Sometimes moments like this, where the party, a particular Republican Party went through this a long time ago. I think back in right after the George H.W. Bush year when Clinton got elected. There was this huge shakeup, and everybody was saying, oh, the Republican Party's done. The Republican Party's through. They'll never come back from this. This is going to be Democrats forever now. And, of course, then in 2000, whether you like it or not, the Supreme Court stepped in and decided that everybody says the Supreme Court decided the election. That's not really the case. That's not what happened here, because Florida was the tipping point. So they had to go through all these paper ballots and the hanging chads and all the crap that they looked at and everything that they had defined by every single ballot that they went through. George Bush won that election, and that there's not much of a question there. Al Gore did not win the election, and of course they had the Supreme Court had the fortitude to step in and weigh in on it. Now, of course, in the 2020 election, John Roberts said, well, there weren't riots back then. There are riots now. We can't step in and do anything. We can't say anything because there were riots. So we're not going to give it any standing. Good for you, Mr. Coward Man. Do your job. My understanding is that the highest paid person in the federal government was Anthony Fauci, $240,000 a year. Something like that. $240,000, almost $300,000 a year. Maybe, I don't know. There are people. Maxine Waters had somebody hired on her staff, on her campaign staff. I think it was her brother-in-law, or was it her husband? Paid him $700,000, $600,000, whatever it was. Some ridiculous amount of money. Out of her campaign funds. And some of these NGOs, where they pay people ridiculous amounts of money. They'll put their son or daughter in charge of something and pay them ridiculous amounts of money. It is all part of the family cadre. And of course, then once you do that, everybody's going to be loyal to you because they don't want to lose that cash cow. I'm going to cut off the hand that's feeding them, of course. Crazy stuff like that goes on all the time. So now, the Democrat Party could possibly redefine itself, come out of this, and actually be stronger than ever before. Now, that's possible. I'm not seeing, but it requires some leadership. And I talked about this yesterday. Who is leading the Democrat Party? There's not really anybody rising to the top. I think that the most viable candidate at this point that they have for president is going to be Gavin Newsom. Now, don't count out Gretchen Whitmer from Michigan, governor. She's also trying to position herself as a centrist now. She has actually appeared in the White House, wherever they were. They were in a meeting with Trump, where Trump was actually giving her accolades. Now, Trump knows that if he appraises any Democrat, that Democrat now all of a sudden is on the hot seat. That is not something, they're not looking for approval from Donald Trump. And he knows if he does that, it puts them in a very awkward position. Do you accept that? Do you receive that? What do you say here? In fact, he called her up. Here's the microphone. Say a few things. Say a few words. All of a sudden, they have a mouthpiece with this administration that they never would have gotten. If Joe Biden had come to town and she'd have been invited to, she would never have been invited to speak. Especially off the cuff by the man himself. He would have just read his script and all the notes that go along with the script and just bumbled through it and then wandered off the stage. He didn't do anything. Donald Trump just, here's the microphone. Do you want to say a few things? Well, I wasn't prepared to say anything, but I guess I'll just say this. She didn't dare say anything negative about the administration. Here's your opportunity. You want to be a big shot? You want to be an activist? You want to speak out against the administration? Here you go. Here's your opportunity. Do it in front of my face instead of behind my back. And that's kind of the. And I think Donald Trump was actually, I think he's very genuine in his offering to reach out a hand and say, let's work together. Let's get something done. Because he's a transactional guy. You can be his enemy, his fierce enemy one day, and the next day come back and say, hey, let's make a deal. Let's do this. And all of a sudden he's your best buddy. You're the greatest person in the world. You're the most wonderful person in the world. And that's just the way he is. He's through and through a business guy, and he's very his relationships are based on that. Now, I don't know what it's like. I assume he's very different in his personal life. I have no idea, but it has to spill over into that. That's to some extent. But obviously, he has raised some children who are not off the deep end. Now, probably most of that was his spouse or spouses, the spouses who've raised them. Probably has a lot more to do with that. But it might have been Warren Buffett, who I don't really have a whole lot of respect for, but he's I mean, I respect the man. I respect the man for what he's, the discipline he went through. He's just a very different individual. He's different, very, very different creature. He went through college. He was the things that he learned and studied in the way he was. He's just like he's like a one in a million, one in a hundred million person type person who has a panache for looking at certain statistics and books and all kinds of things. The way he was doing. To hear his story is pretty amazing. But anyway, one of the things, I think it was him that said this. He said, I want to give my children enough that they can do anything that they want, but not so much that they don't have to do anything. And so, if they have an idea, they have something that they want to do, you fund that, you get behind it. So, okay, let's do this. I'm not going to give them, but they need to have some kind of motivation. They need to be off their butts and to get the job done. There has to be some kind of motivation. The best motivation in the world is when you get hungry or when you get, when you want something enough that you're willing to work to get earn some money to get it, to achieve something. Or you have a passion for something enough to go through. That's one of the things about many, many professional careers. You have a passion to do something. Aviation is a huge one in this respect. There's many others that are out there. But for instance, aviation is one of those things where you have a passion to do something and you're going to do it. You're going to find a way to get that job. Because you enjoy doing it so much that you're just so fascinated by it. Whatever it is that's the motivation within that. It's just, you get bit by that bug and all of a sudden that's what you want to do. And you start going through the process and you realize by the time you get to where you're at. Now, in today's world, it's a little different. Kids are coming right out of college, walking into aviation careers, and they start whining and crying if they have to wait 6 months or a year before they get hired by an airline. It's what just blows my mind because it was years. I didn't think there would ever be a day when I'd be hired by an airline. I never set myself up in my career to do that because I just didn't think that was going to be possible. For one, I didn't have a college education. I didn't have a college degree, I should say. So I just thought I was going to go down a different path. I thought I was going to be a corporate guy or a bush pilot or do something like that. Next thing I know, out of the blue, I get a call that to go to work for a small airline. It worked out very well. But I had, I had over 4,000 hours. I had almost 2,800 hours of dual instruction time given. In other words, I was an instructor with 2,800 hours of instruction time. Kids today are working for airlines and their total time isn't even 2,800 hours. They're usually right around the 1,000 hour mark. 750 to 1,000. They have what they call a restricted ATP, or airline transport pilot certificate. They can get a 750 hour. So it's kind of a of total time. So it's a very different world. Could be a captain with 1,000 hours. Oh, 1,000 hours, I should say, 1,000 hours of 121 time, of airline time. So you can be very low on the total time and be a captain. Relatively low. I mean, it's not... what's the word? I don't want to alarm anybody here. It's you're still trained. You're still meet standards. It's all the things you have to do. And the training is good. It's not, however, that experience, the experience level is different. I'm not saying one is better than the other. Training is probably better today than it was back in the 80s, 90s. However, it's because the simulators are so much better. Can do things in the Sims now that we weren't able to do back in the 90s. But there's definitely a shortage, and there's more people doing more with less time. However, and it's anyway, I don't know where I was going with all that. Where did I start off with this whole thing? That's just what I'm trying to search back on my thoughts here. Not what I was talking about. The Democrat Party, everything else that was going on there. But the so the aviation careers, some people are motivated by passion. and they're willing to go through all the hassles of getting of jumping all the hurdles, getting everything done. Nursing is that way. There's a lot you do. You know, you go through rigorous schooling, expensive schooling, just to be able to pay for your college. You know, whether you're racking up debt or whether you're trying to pay for it as you go, that's probably the tougher route to go. Racking up the debt's easy. Paying it off is tough. If you pay it off as you go, that's the tough part. When I was going through, I went through 1 year of college. I had two jobs while I was going through college, 1 year. And I still had a grant on top of that. I had a grant. I also had a student loan. And I was, that's how I paid for it up front. But then I had two jobs while I was attending college. And I wonder why I didn't make it through more than 1 year of college. I got out of college and I already had this debt that was over my head. And I was like, you know, this isn't working really well. I knew youth pastors don't make a lot of money. That's what I was kind of going to school for. And I was like, you know, I don't think this is going to work out too well. I don't see this ending well. If I go through 4 years of college for a job that pays, you know, $12,000 a year, whatever it is, and I end up with $80,000 in debt, whatever it was going to be. It wasn't going to be $80,000, but it was probably going to be more like $17,000 or $18,000 at the time. Today, in today's money, that's, you know, closer to $80,000. So I wasn't going to work out well. I didn't see things working out well there. Considering I already had a job, one of my part-time jobs was as a youth pastor. So I was already doing the job. But I was also working night security at the college as well. It's ridiculous. So that's paying as you go or paying for more of it up front rather than just racking up the debt and trying to pay it off later, which is, I see a lot of people doing that now, especially in the aviation industry. It's just so much. It's so expensive to get your license because there's the cost of the operation of the airplane that was involved in all that. Many other education, there's say a commercial diver, for instance. People who just love diving, they want to get into that career. It's all a big deal for them. They love the challenge. They love that there's something about it that they love the whole industry. They love what they're doing. A lot of it's the challenge and the thrill and that whole thing. I looked into that when I was a high school student. I wanted to be a commercial diver. I was probably a junior in high school, sophomore maybe, when I thought that was what I wanted to do. And I talked to one of my guidance counselors, one of the most awesome people on the planet. Her name was Mrs. Loidle. So it's the only way we knew. I don't know what her first name was. I think I knew it one time, but I can't remember what it is. Mrs. Loidle. I went in and told her I wanted to be a commercial diver. And I couldn't even drive a car yet. I wasn't even 16. I think it was my junior year in high school. Before I left her office, she had already called someone on the phone that she knew was a scuba diving instructor. And basically had me set up with a schedule when the classes were with a YMCA. And I ended up signing up for that. One of my buddies joined me. In fact, his dad drove us to the class every week. I think it was twice a week. And went through this whole process. Did our open water dives, the whole thing. And I was hooked. And the only reason it happened, is because of her. I'm almost positive I would never have gone through that process of finding a scuba instructor. I had no idea where to start that process at all. Probably wouldn't have looked into it. You know, the internet wasn't a thing then, back then. You would have had to like look into the newspaper, find classes somewhere, call the YMCA, do something. She didn't just sit there and say, well, then you need to take these classes. There you go. Good luck. She got involved and had me set up before I walked out the door. She recently passed away. I think it was like a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Awesome person. So many testimonies from kids in my class that were, she changed their lives. She was a believer, and it was just, it was very obvious when you walked into her office. The things that she had hanging on her wall, the things that she did. Just an incredible person. But it was one of those things where, you know, I was passionate about scuba diving. Well, then I find out that scuba divers back then, commercial divers, the whole career path to become a commercial diver, because you had to be an intern for a while to do all this kind of stuff. It was very expensive to get your process. However, what kind of offset some of that expense was that you actually worked as a tender, you did some other things, you got involved in the industry. So you had a job as you were learning. And so there were things, you know, you kind of worked as an apprentice, so to speak. And I got hooked up with a local commercial diver here in town. There was actually a scuba diving guy that had, he went all over the place, all over the region. Lived right here in town, right in my hometown. And the stories he had to tell about diving and stuff he did was just unbelievable. Some of the stuff he would do, diving into vats of glue, all kinds of stuff he did. However, after hanging around with the guy for a while and the stuff he would do, I started realizing that commercial divers died a lot. They didn't make it very long. Their average lifespan was very short. They kind of dropped like flies. This is back in a day when the safety measures, some of the things that were going on, they were not like they are now. It's still a dangerous job, don't get me wrong. But yeah, it was commercial diving was a very dangerous thing back in the 80s, especially in the 70s. And I kind of changed my opinion about the whole thing when I started finding all this out a little bit. So my passion kind of changed. I thought, well, maybe I could get involved in like marine biology. Of course, my biology teacher in high school found this out. And of course, I was the pet in the class now, all of a sudden, because I was going to become a biologist. So now every time he'd talk about anything marine biology, anything kind of marine animal, or he would look at me directly in class. So it was it's hilarious. And I really wasn't that interested in becoming a marine. I just kind of threw it out there. So, well, everybody keeps asking me what I want to do when I grow up. I said, I'll say marine biologist. Sounds good. I did, however, become a scuba instructor. As soon as I got out of high school, still had the passion for diving. And I worked for almost a year in a factory to save up money and to kind of, you know, living from home, doing the whole thing. Saved up some money, went off to California at the Patty Gold College, International Diving College. It was in San Diego, California. It was actually about close to Point Loma, just off Rosecrans. And the college lasted for about 7 or 8 years, and I think they closed their doors. I guess the water softener is kicking in. So I thought it was one of my dogs. By the way, I have both dogs down here today, here at the home studio. And the reason I can have both dogs, and they're not on a leash or anything. They're just down here. The puppy's on his little thing. He's sleeping because he hears my voice snoring. The Australian Shepherd is also at my feet underneath my desk. And they're both passed out, snoring, basically. No drama. We had a whole drama-free night with the door open on our bed. Bedroom. I'm sorry, door open on our bedroom. Dogs could go wherever they wanted to, and they stayed there right there in the bedroom, and they, you know, laid right by the bed. It's on my side of the bed over there, just where they, because it's close to the picture window. That's where the beds are. The other dog usually stays, the small dog usually goes to in the bathroom, lays on the floor in the shower room, because it's nice and quiet in there, and he hangs out by the air conditioner vent. The The other dog kind of every couple 10, 20 minutes, he gets up and moves around. But the at about 2 o'clock in the morning this morning, he came up and bit me. He booped me. I think they call it a boop. His nose kind of came up and pushed me a little bit in bed. He was checking in on me, making sure I was still there. Make sure everything was okay. I pet him a little bit, and then he was, rub his neck a little bit. And he yawns, and he goes back to sleep. And no drama. There was no drama at all. The drama happens because they like to chase the cats. So anytime the cats try to move or do anything normal, go to eat or go to the bathroom or do anything at all, they're all over that. And it's the little one that actually, our Australian Shepherd starts to whine and kind of get the other one riled up. And then, of course, he gets riled up and then he goes chasing after the cat. And then the little one acts like he's going to save the day and stop the big one from... It's a crazy drama show. So, of course, the one big cat, he'll sit up on his little throne up on the top of this little tower thing we have for him. And the big dog can reach that high because he jumps up on the sofa. And then it's just the whole thing. It's a big show. And of course, he sticks his nose up in that cat's face, and that cat starts to hiss and starts to swat him. And so it's a big, of course, he doesn't care. He's so happy-go-lucky. He'll just jump back down off the sofa, run around the house, then come back over and jump on up there again. And, this is the dog that can jump over the sofa, not just jump up on the sofa. He'll just go over the sofa. And I don't think he realizes how, I just heard there's a dog, same breed. Someone said that they were on the other side of a fence at their house the other day, and they have a 6-foot fence. And the dog just jumped over the fence from standing still, jumped over the fence. Now, I assume they didn't clear the fence. He didn't clear the fence from standing still. I assume he was able to get over the top of the fence and then jump down. He had to use the top of the fence to get over it. This dog, my dog, yes, he could do that. I know he could. I've got a 5-foot fence around the back of my, what's formerly known as the pool area, our fenced-in yard part. I'm pretty sure he could jump over it if he really wanted to. He just doesn't know he can yet. And I'm not going to teach him yet. Not yet. Not until he's obeying a little bit better. Because he would definitely be out in the yard running, chasing deer, whatever he wants. Occasionally there are deer in our backyard, and he probably would, he'll see them from the fence, and he'll just run around the fence, and he'll climb a tree. He literally puts his feet up on trees. If he starts smelling an animal up a tree or smelling anything at the park, his front paws go right up the tree, and I think if he would hit opposable thumbs, he would just go right up the thing. But anyway, enough is enough. We have, this is probably going to be the last show of the week. I don't know if I'm going to have a show tomorrow morning. I'm going to be in Virginia later today, and I'm going to be there over the weekend. My nephew's graduating high school, so we're going to be out there for that. Probably going to be back later on the weekend. If all goes well, if the car keeps running and everything happens the way it's supposed to. So that's the plan. We're going to get out there and back. Going to get out there today, graduation, come back on Sunday probably. That's the plan. We'll see how that works out. In the meantime, I will probably not have a show tomorrow. However, Monday morning, even though I'll be tired, it'll be a regular show. And then sometime, at some point next week, I do have a few appointments to help with, but I hopefully have a live show. God bless, folks. Shabbat shalom. Have a great rest of your weekend, rest of your week. Take care. See ya.